Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, South Sudan is facing renewed conflict, but that's only a small part of this new country's dilemmas. We'll hear from a nurse who has just returned from South Sudan. Then how can countries with so many natural resources and mineral wealth remain in such poverty? The conflict in South Sudan has claimed 1,000 lives, according to United Nations humanitarian officials. Leaders in Africa are working to negotiate a peace agreement between South Sudan's government and the rebels. But South Sudan, as the world's newest country, faces many more crises. With us is Miriam Check, a nurse from the organization Doctors Without Borders, or Médecins Sans Frontières, who has recently returned from South Sudan. Welcome, Miriam Check. It's great to have you here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you've just returned from South Sudan.
Yes.
You're on a mission.
Yeah.
The mission Doctors Without Borders.
Yes.
And you're a nurse.
Yes.
How would you describe the situation there on the ground?
The state I was in the north, close to the border with the country Sudan. South Sudan is the newest country in the world. It is recently independent since 2011. And they had many years of conflict with trying to break away from Sudan. And as the newest country in the world, they have a real deficit in normal, just everyday resources, especially human resources, infrastructure, and access to things that you and I would take completely for granted. One of the things that they lack most of all, of course, is good health care. As a nurse, I was sent to train the nurses who are on the ground working already for Doctors Without Borders. You'll hear me refer to us as MSF during the interview. If that's okay, we use the French acronym. The hospital that we have there is a Ministry of Health hospital that we call that MOH, meaning for Ministry of Health. We frequently work in partnership with the MOH of various countries. In this hospital, the MOH is continuing to work with the adult population, and MSF is running the maternity and the pediatric. The situation there is pretty dire, about as bad as I have seen, in terms of the general health of the population and their access to good care. The children there is a lot of malnutrition. When I was there, we were in the process of closing down our serious intensive feeding center. That's called a TFC, therapeutic feeding center, because the malnutrition rates were dropping low enough that we could keep it ambulatory, outpatient, and hand off some of the work to other agencies. That being said, there is still some serious malnutrition. There's very serious lack of basic childhood vaccination. So we see things like neonatal tetanus and stuff that, you know, you and I would have considered to be eradicated a long time ago. There were rumored to be a couple of cases of polio. As it happened, they turned out to be not polio. But nevertheless, you know, childhood diseases that we consider to be either unimportant or eradicated. The mother-child health situation is also pretty dire. Many of the women we don't see, obviously, because they either don't make it to the hospital or they don't know about the hospital or they can't get there in time. So those who do arrive in the hospital are already the lucky ones. That being said, again, many of the deliveries were normal and safe, but an extraordinary number are still seriously complicated deliveries. We had the great good fortune of being able to build an operating theatre in 2013 in that hospital, so we do daily C-sections, which save untold numbers of lives.
Are you seeing much in terms of the conflict coming through the medical centres, or do you not see much of that?
So personally, no. In this hospital, in Awil, in the northern state of northern Bahr al-Ghazal, I don't even know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, excuse me, not so much. We did see the fallout from the conflict. Now, this being a pediatric, as part of the hospital that we are running, we don't see an awful lot of trauma anyway. The trauma that we do are childhood accidents or abscesses, infections like that. So it is possible that there is some conflict-related trauma going on, but I don't think so because we certainly didn't witness it on any ongoing basis.
And you were there for how long?
3 months, 2.5 months. specifically. So in that area, it's more that we see the fallout from the conflict. You know, the immediate conflict causes, of course, injuries and horrible, horrible things. You know, the violence in itself is a horrific thing to live through. But that being said, the long-term consequences are the suffering and the loss of the lifestyle, the crops, the harvest. You've lost your home, you've lost your way of living. And it is that causes more, in terms of numbers, that causes more human suffering and misery than the violence of a conflict itself.
And we tend to forget that piece or not even think about that piece, because as soon as the conflict, the flaring down of it, the attention is taken away.
Yes, exactly. The attention goes away. It's not glamorous anymore. You know, people who are sick from regular diseases like, malaria and abscess. To be honest, you know, if I don't want to be too superficial, but basically, it's not sexy anymore. So the media attention is drawn away to the next sexy, glamorous conflict. And the long-term aftermath continues. It's an ongoing emergency, if you like. The children who are growing up from the consequences of this conflict, and that being said, it's starting up again right now. It's far from being over. But the children who grow up in the aftermath of a conflict are, in a way, as traumatized, even if they were born... They were themselves born post actual conflict. They are the ones who carry the worst of the burdens. The loss of the simple things like basic education. Apparently, less than 5% of the kids even go to school, let alone finish even primary school. Basic knowledge. There is so much traditional knowledge that gets lost. One of the things we have to work with is to teach the young mothers how to do good breastfeeding and good bonding with their children. Things that, again, we take for granted as something that they know about, but after so many decades of disruption, they have lost even their simple wisdoms. The people that I was working with, the Dinka, have a very, very strong and ancient identity, and they're famous throughout the world in anthropological circles for having held on to their traditional identity. And that they still have very, very strongly, but they don't have the knowledge, the education, and they don't have access to even the most basic of human needs, you know, the things that we just take for granted.
I assume the basic things also include things like making sure their water is clean and...
Absolutely, absolutely. And clean water is something that it should be a universal human right, and to not have that... Even if there is water to have to go far to get it, we've all seen these images of people walking a long way. When it takes the majority of your day just to run a simple, simple household, just to organize enough water and fuel to cook a little something, to keep yourself clean, to keep your family clean, simple things like chores become a full-time job in themselves. How do you get beyond that? How do you then reclaim a life and a culture and a way of life? That's the extremely difficult thing. And in the meantime, the ongoing medical emergencies just continue nonstop.
You have also done missions in the Congo and in Yemen, is that right?
Yes, I was in Congo DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo. I was there in the province of southeastern province of Katanga in 2007. And Yemen I was in earlier this year, late last year and early this year.
And how would you compare what you saw, say, in the Congo with what you saw in South Sudan? Was it very similar?
Yes. What I saw in the Congo, now, mind you, I wasn't working there as a nurse at that time. And even in South Sudan, I was the trainer nurse. I wasn't doing that much bedside caring. But I would say the situation was very similar at that time. It was a people who were coming out of a conflict situation and really didn't have... access. They didn't have infrastructure and they had lost their way of life. They didn't have simple resources to try to reclaim their way of life. Things like roads, you know, tarmac is such a misunderstood and misunderestimated resource. Fuel, you know, the shortage of fuel was so severe and the fuel prices are so extraordinarily high. I can remember as a human resource coordinator, I believe that almost 50% of our budget was spent on fuel and sometimes just on the amount, the cost of carrying fuel itself, the fuel costs for that were extremely high as well, because we had to carry barrels of petroleum up and down the Congo River during the flood season. The medical situation was pretty similar also. We had a cholera outbreak. We didn't have cholera this time in South Sudan while I was there, but it was definitely a high risk. We had a few suspected cases. But it was those preventable childhood diseases that really kill off the kids in these huge numbers. So that was the big similarity. And folks not being able to bring their child rapidly to a healthcare facility, nor understanding how quickly this child is going to decline. The reason being usually is that they have a level of chronic malnutrition, so that then when they get even a simple case of measles, something again that you and I would brush off, not even consider to be serious, can kill a child in a couple of days from the respiratory complications.
And did you see any of the conflictual problems there in the Congo also?
Not so much. It being a very far-flung country at that time, the province that I was in happened to be a relatively peaceful region. It is the ancestral homeland of the Kabila family. And the main town where we have our main headquarters in that region, Lubumbashi, is a relatively large, peaceful, and well-managed town. What I was able to see was the lack of trust between people who consider themselves to be from the same country. There's still a lot of internal, perhaps racism is an overly strong word, but certainly mistrust, suspicion of folks from other areas. People don't have enough for themselves, so they hang on to what they do have, and anybody else is considered an outsider. Anybody who might be a threat to their own resources is a potential enemy, and will rapidly turn back into that enemy. And I think a little bit of that is what's going on in South Sudan at the present.
And Yemen, we don't hear much about what's going on there.
I was in two areas. I was in the south in a town called Aden, and I was in the north in a town called Khamir. Aden is very southern. So what we have to understand that Yemen is one country, but really it's almost impossible to describe. For one thing, it's certainly very clearly divided into north and south. And there is a well-articulated, serious secessionist political movement underway that frequently also erupts into violence. And Yemen, a little bit like South Sudan, is extraordinarily tribal. It's a tribal society. People resolve most of their conflicts according to tribal traditions and tribal justice. People align themselves, of course, with their tribal identity. Here in the West, we tend to put an excessively political, we have an allegiance along what we think of a party lines, and we understand the Yemeni culture according to the way we live politically, and that is not the case at all. We all know that Yemen has an Al-Qaeda problem. I was training some nurses who had come to our local hospital from a village a couple of hours away, and we were talking about, you know, hospital culture and how to run things and how to manage a hospital. And so I asked them about security, because we had very, very high security in our hospital. We're very proud of it, with, you know, guards and habits of checking the visitors and so on and so forth. So I asked these nurses from the village hospital, what do you do about security? And they laughed. They almost fell out of their chairs. And the translator explained to me that what they had for security were sticks. And when the Al-Qaeda bomber came into their compound to blow them up, they chased him away, and he was wrapped in bombs. He was coming to blow a suicide
bomber.
That's
a great story.
Yeah. They chased him off with their sticks, and they wanted me to come visit their village so they could show me the hole in the wall where he had managed to blow himself up, but it was outside the hospital compound.
So he came in to be a suicide bomber, got chased away by women with sticks.
Nurses with sticks, men and women.
I like that. Nurses with sticks. Yeah. You're back here in the U.S., and I'm sure you're seeing the news reports on South Sudan, a little bit on Yemen, a little bit about the Congo. How accurate do you think mass media are in depicting these places?
That's an excellent question. I think overall they do a pretty good job. It also, you know, I come in with my own prejudices. The moment I start reading anything that has been depicted by mass media, I'm already, of course, irritated as someone who thinks of herself as having been on the ground, you know. So I have a little bit of a insider cowboy mentality already. I think there's an inevitable generalization that goes on. There are sometimes explanations along, you know, well, it's this party and that party, and these are the causes, and, you know, these folks live over here, and this is the geography of such and such a people. And I think these stories, for sure, we need to have a context, we need to have a geopolitical context in order to understand any kind of story that is not our own. At the same time, sometimes the mass media can overgeneralize to the point of almost falsifying the true realities. In South Sudan, where I was just now, for example, this doesn't put the Dinka people into a particularly positive light, but this is an example. The nurses that I was working with are quite racist and resented.
Racist against people within their own society?
Yes, against people whom they don't consider to be, well, who are not Dinka. And resented the fact that a lot of the supervisors in the hospital are not Dinka. And used excuses like, well, we need Dinka speakers in order to do our job effectively. And basically, they didn't like staff from different states in their own so-called country. And this is my point. For them, South Sudan is a little bit of a fantasy. One time when they were sitting outside waiting to pick up their pay, I jollily asked them to start singing their national anthem. And they didn't really know it. And when we teased them about, you know, trying to improve their football team, that's soccer, yeah, they were more interested in Arsenal and Chelsea, and they didn't really show much pride or even interest in their nation as a nation. They are proud of their president because he's a fellow Dinka, and he came to see us at the hospital, and the mothers of the patients were openly weeping with delight and pride. The staff also, we were all quite excited about it, but the staff were extremely proud to have their president come and to show him the hospital. But it was almost as if they were proud about him being a Dinka as much as the president of their so-called nation.
And similarly, in other countries, you found a contrast to what we understand from this part via media versus what you see?
I do. I have seen that. I know that this is a very politically incorrect thing to say, but I have seen it again in Yemen. You know, the tribe and the family and the clan come first. I think the difference is more that they're just more aware of it and more honest about stating it. In our culture, we sort of... We claim ourselves ethnically along, you know, XYZ, PC ethnic groups. I'm a such and such American. But we believe it to be most important to claim ourselves nationally first. And I don't think that's particularly true of human beings. And I think one of the differences is that they just know it better than we do. And they know that, you know, when there's a fight over resources, land, they're going to settle back down along family and clanic lines. And they just keep that more, they keep that awareness more, they're more aware of it on a daily basis than we are.
Now, how frequently do you go on these missions?
Not so frequently. So DRC was, that's the Congo, was in 2007. I came back from that and then decided to go to nursing school and, you know, became a nurse and gathered a few years' experience here in San Fernando Valley before being eligible to leave again for the field. So for the time being, I guess we'll consider ourselves, I think of us, my husband is also full-time in the field. I guess for now...
Is he also a nurse? Is he a doctor?
No, he started off as a logistician and then became a project coordinator and is now head of mission. He just wrapped up the project of Somalia, and MSF has now left Somalia en masse for the time being.
Because of the conflict there?
The security situation, yeah. That's another whole story, but yeah, the security situation there is so dire that our integrity and our mandate and integrity unto ourselves was being compromised unacceptably.
Thank you so much for being with us, Miriam Czech. It's great to have you here with us, and I hope we get you back here again.
Oh, it's an honor and a privilege. Thank you so much.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. When we come back, how are the so-called extractive industries related to conflicts and corruption? Stay tuned.
Stake the claim and find the truth to be self-evident. Then break the chain in two with what you say.
You're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. What is the relationship between minerals such as oil, diamonds, gold, and conflict, authoritarianism, and poverty? This week's scholars have spent years studying how these so-called extractive industries, mining and drilling, impact people's lives, their governance, and the environment throughout the world. How can countries so rich in mineral wealth remain mired in so much poverty? Three experts join us. Jeffrey Mance is a professor of anthropology at George Mason University. His publications include Improvisational Economies, Coltan Production in the Eastern Congo, and How a Huckster Becomes a Custodian of Moral Markets. Michael Ross also joins us. Michael Ross is a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, and director of the Center for Southeast Asian Studies. He's the author of The Oil Curse, How Petroleum Shapes the Development of Nations, and Timber Booms and Institutional Breakdown in Southeast Asia. Susanna Sawyer also joins us. Susanna Sawyer is a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Davis. She is the author of Crude Chronicles, Indigenous Politics, Multinational Oil, and Neoliberalism in Ecuador. She's also co-editor of The Politics of Resource Extraction, Indigenous Peoples, Corporations, and the State. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle. I'd like to start with the Congo. Jeff Mance, you've been studying it. It's experienced one of the most brutal conflicts, primarily over this mineral, coltan, that we use for our cell phones. You made some comparisons, one to blood diamonds, one to sugar plantations by the European colonies in the Caribbean. How does this compare to those?
Coltan, or columbite tantalite, is this dense silicate. It's a very heavy mineral that you find in the ground that essentially you're able to take the tantalite out of it and turn and refine it into something called tantalum, and this is used as a heat-resistant conductor. What a lot of scientists called the holy grail, the digital age, is that we needed mobile devices and other kinds of electronics that were able to hold a charge for a long period of time. So essentially it took from cell phones from being sort of a commodity that was kind of servicing, you know, the sort of more wealthy into a different sort of space where, you know, this was the kind of commodity that was available to the rest of the planet, that everybody could have a cell phone. And in fact, people do. One of the interesting things about the cell phone in Africa and the minerals that come out of the Congo is that you have this coming full circle, and the cell phones, when a militia comes over and tries to take over a coltan mine or a village, the first thing they do is confiscate all the cell phones, and they've used in cell phones in the past to coordinate their attacks on villages and so forth. So there's this sort of circularity to the product. Historically, sugar had an enormous role to play in terms of the transformations that kind of were ushering in industrialization in Europe and in Britain specifically. So the sugar economies of the Caribbean took sugar from being this kind of product that was servicing the elite, that was really originally was a spice. Then it got turned into this product that was kind of widely available and everybody wanted it in their tea, and it became sort of this plebeian kind of commodity. So you see it had a similar sort of effect. In the process of becoming this widely consumed commodity, it kind of grew these industrial industrial centers like London. And so you have the same sort of phenomena happening with the digital age and the sort of economic transformations that are unfolding there. So that's kind of the parallel that one makes to that. Of course, the blood diamond angle is that whereas, you know, diamonds are a luxury item, the difference with these items in the Congo is that the conflict's happening around coltan historically and the problems that the Congo has faced, including the deaths of millions of people, most from starvation, as a result really of trafficking in a mineral that's essential for a product that most of us own.
When you went to the Congo and you studied the process, it was all pretty devastating in terms of how entire communities become swept up into this and the conflict that came out of it and how the process goes through other countries to then ultimately end up in the cell phones. Can you give us a quick walk through all of that?
Sure. There are some government-controlled mines, and there are some sort of more formal mining centers and so forth. But most of the people who are involved in coltan production are involved as small-scale artisanal miners. And there's literally hundreds of thousands of them. The interesting thing about this is, as much as one is inclined to demonize the trade, which is precisely what happened with Dodd-Frank, it's actually an important source of labor. But essentially, you have a bunch of different stakeholders in this, and a lot of it makes its way illegally, or illicitly, I should say, mostly out through Rwanda, and gets rebranded as some other kind of coltan other than Congolese coltan. So in the case of Rwanda, they'll claim Rwanda, according to the USGS, eclipses Congo in terms of its coltan production, which is just absolutely asinine. There's no way a small country like that that is on the wrong side of the geological fault could really exploit whatever reserves it has. Reserves are doubtful at that. So you have a lot of it being what I call laundered. There's a lot of mineral laundering that goes on that contributes to the rebranding of coltan as Rwandan coltan or as, you know, Australian coltan or as coltan from some other part of the world. And we've had that going on for quite some time.
Now, Michael Ross, you've looked at this in big picture, but you've also looked at some Asian countries and their extractive industries. You've looked at oil, timber, diamonds. Where do you see this, and how does it compare to what we're hearing from Jeff Matz?
There are a lot of similarities, particularly in Indonesia and in Myanmar, where you have both countries very fragmented ethnically, dozens and dozens of different ethnic and linguistic groups. And often there's a lot of resentment about foreign companies or outside companies coming in and digging up local resources and making a huge profit over it, especially when the profits go to the government or to some company and the local people are stuck with all of the environmental and social harm done by some very large and often very dirty mining operations. In Indonesia, you see this all across this, you know, this vast archipelago from Aceh in the west to West Papua in the far east. And the dynamics seem, you know, they sound very similar to what Jeff was describing in the Congo.
In terms of the conflict and the corruption and the kind of laundering sense of it?
Mm-hmm. I think probably the closest comparison in Asia would be in Myanmar, where you have the central government not really controlling that much in the kind of peripheral parts of the country. And in those peripheral regions, you have sometimes economies that are built around the extraction of minerals, often controlled by some warlord or whatever faction has the most weaponry, the most kind of brute force. And, you know, people can labor away under brutal conditions and make almost no money from it.
And when they don't, they can also get very punished by the people controlling that.
That's right. Perhaps, you know, what's remarkable and distinctive about the Congo case that Jeff was describing is, you know, this sort of transnational connection to the devices that so many of us carry around and that it's so central to kind of the modern information economy that gives everybody a kind of intimate link to this, you know, almost scandalous extraction process going on the other side of the world.
Now, oil also is an extractive industry. It's quite different for obvious reasons and controlled by multinational corporations most of the time. Susanna Sawyer, you've studied this in Latin America, particularly in the Amazon area, and you found some exploitations there that contrast here. How would you compare these?
Well, I think there are some differences, just especially with the work that Jeffrey has been involved in, where he's looking largely at coltan that's deriving, that's coming from artisanal mining for the most part, which is very different from large-scale multinational oil exploration and extraction, at least in the Amazonian area. My research has looked specifically at the conflicts that have emerged between multinational corporations and indigenous peoples in the Amazon region. And for the most part, the largest, most significant effect of those operations has been the environmental degradation and contamination that has resulted. There are, at times, during extraction, well, exploration and extraction, there are some benefits that local communities can encounter, depending on the types of arrangements that get built and mediated, negotiated with local communities. But they're often very short-term. They're often based on not a full understanding on the part of indigenous peoples of what is at stake. And for the most part, they end up collapsing and coming back to haunt many people who have engaged in them.
I remember a couple of lawsuits, one in Burma, one in Nigeria, against some of these oil giants. And I know there's also been one in Ecuador that I think you've been following.
Yeah.
But there's been quite a contrast. I think the Burma one resulted in a very large settlement for the indigenous people in the region. Nigeria did not turn out that way. One was Unocal, Chevron was Nigeria, and the Ecuador one is also Chevron. Is that right?
That's correct. I mean, the lawsuits are different. They're not necessarily directly comparable, although they are with oil companies. But the one in Ecuador has specifically to do with the long-term effects of oil operations initiated by Texaco, but a corporation that merged with Chevron. So now it's a lawsuit against Chevron for environmental contamination and then the health effects of that contamination. It's been a really long-standing, very complex lawsuit, but ultimately resulted in Ecuador in a ruling against Chevron, finding it has $9 billion liability that essentially will be used for, should it ever be recuperated or recovered, should that money would be used for largely environmental remediation.
As I understand, very recently in mid-December, a Canadian court has said that, in fact, they should be able to collect this.
Yes, I think it was last week. It was a Ontario Court of Appeals that said that the Ecuadorian plaintiffs did indeed have a right to use Canada as a jurisdiction through which they could then make a claim for the enforcement of the Ecuadorian ruling. So that was a court decision that was overruling a lower court Ontario decision. So it was an appeals court decision that was really paving the way for them to think of Canada as a jurisdiction, a forum, a legal forum through which they could enforce the Ecuadorian ruling.
So what we've got here is several different scenarios, but all of them resulting in a kind of exploitation. Michael Ross, this is an area that you've been studying in this big picture way about the relationship between some of these extractive industries and problems such as conflict and corruption and authoritarianism. Let's look at these one by one. Perhaps let's start with conflict and the relationship that you're finding between extractive industries and civil war or other kinds of violent conflicts. What are the conditions?
You know, there's maybe 50 countries around the world that extract a significant amount of oil or gas. Many of them are exporters, and the number is growing as there's been new investment, new exploration, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, but also parts of Latin America. And yet when you look around the world and you look at these 50 or so countries, you find that they have unusually high rates of civil war. And often these wars seem to be around these these oil facilities. And I think the most common pattern, one that we've sort of already touched on, is that when oil is found in the territory of a group that feels disenfranchised, marginalized, they get resentful. And there may be the government or companies may be anticipating this and may be especially repressive in those regions. I think we saw that in Sudan and Indonesia at one point. And it may be that there are local insurgencies or independence movements that use this kind of as a rallying cry. You know, they are stealing our minerals. They are stealing our wealth. If we were getting our fair share, we would be much better off now. Countries that often think they're going to, you know, get this sort of leap forward in wealth and development from discovering oil often does not seem to find themselves mired in these endemic conflicts where a lot of the profits just get squandered on long-running insurgencies and repression.
Jeff Mance, would you say that this fits in what you've seen in the Congo?
Yeah, I mean, the situation in the Congo is, you see some interesting parallels. What I like about what Mike Ross is saying is that a refreshing way of looking at it from what typically has been regarded as kind of a resource curse hypothesis propounded by the economist Jeffrey Sachs and others about the tendency for countries that have that are wealthy in resources to sort of be at the bottom end of the economic chain in terms of the benefits that accrue to their society from having these resources. There seems to be historical evidence for this, but you're left with this sort of nasty kind of taste in your mouth that, actually it may not be the existence of the resources and the inability to exploit them, but the fact that they're exploited by outsiders and that there's not appropriate forms of accountability that result from this. That's something that you see very much articulated by Congolese. If you comment to a Congolese person on poverty in the Congo, you say, you know, wow, this looks poor, the first thing that they'll sort of jolt back at you and say, the Congo is a very, very wealthy country, and be fairly adamant about that in terms of their pride in that and the fact that they have these resources and, you know, that anything can grow there and anything can be found in the ground. And they really see the problems they have for what they are, and that is that they're facilitated by outsiders who exploit particular kinds of disagreements that people have over land and resources and exploit people's goodwill and pillage and do all sorts of things like that. So I would say, yes, that the resources themselves, these resource curse kinds of literature sometimes leave you thinking that you kind of forget about the people and all of this. You know, where are the people and how they feel about it? And in fact, it's very much, Congolese very much have a very real recognition of what the political economy is going on the ground. They're not naive to it at all. And where they choose to direct their energy is precisely at those points of conflict.
When you say they talk about the outsiders that are coming in and essentially robbing them of their wealth, are they speaking of the West or are they speaking of other African countries?
Well, I think most often they talk about it as in terms of Rwanda exploitation. Rwanda and Uganda in particular really have exploited the situation in the Congo to their advantage. The governments have and a number of individuals, Kigali and Kampala, who are now part of the Kigali and Kampala elites, have made themselves very wealthy off this conflict. That's, I think, where they see most, you know, directly the connections there. The West is a bit more indirect. The French and Americans are sometimes picked on specifically by the Congolese, but that's largely because we have these close diplomatic connections to Rwanda and, you know, provide a lot of aid for them. That produces a lot of rumors and mysteries and those kinds of things. But it's not like you have American companies going directly into the Congo and setting up shop, this more elaborate chain that takes place. So they're taking raw minerals out and they work their way through Malaysia or Beijing or any number of other places, and eventually it ends up in an iPhone or something like that, which is an American company. And people understand the commodity chain, but the sort of proximate kind of wrath is more directed at their neighbors.
Susanna Sawyer, what about in Latin America where you're studying?
Well, it's slightly different with respect to oil, and I guess also with respect to mining somewhat. There haven't been, I mean, historically, yes, there have been large insurgency movements in Latin America, but more recently, in the last few, well, the last decade, two decades, there has emerged a lot of conflict around resource extraction, but the forms of conflict that have emerged are not armed. They're not local insurgencies in the same sense. They're definitely directed when they're large multinational operations. They're definitely directed toward the outside to some extent, but also very much around national legislation and the national government and wanting to. A lot of indigenous organizations who have built collaborations with large environmental groups and more progressive entities within different countries have built strong alliances for rewriting constitutions, for rewriting mineral laws, rewriting hydrocarbon laws, such that in some countries, and you see this in Ecuador, you see this in Bolivia, to some extent in Peru, although that seems to be more emerging, is a whole different form of wanting to imagine what development might look like otherwise, that doesn't rely on resource extractions, that these are actually discussions that are taken seriously. They're not seen as they were maybe 30 years ago as fairly peripheral, but now they're part of the mainstream conversations around resource extraction, and it largely has to do with questions of the environment, of indigenous rights, of, in the case of Ecuador and Bolivia, of the rights of nature, around global warming. So there's a different conversation that's also been generated through these conflicts.
So I wonder, one of the things that you had written in one of your pieces, you were talking about a paradox that had emerged, and that had to do with these constitutions and laws all over the world that were supposed to be protecting the rights of indigenous people, and yet they're still experiencing similar exploitation. Do you think that's turned a corner? Because it sounds like you're saying it has.
Well, it really depends on where. In Latin America, in particular countries, especially countries that have, well, in South America, have significant indigenous populations, it's not that it's turned a corner, but the whole debate has shifted. And it's not as though there's a victory in any sense from an indigenous point of view, but the debate has radically changed and transformed. And yet you go to other countries in Southeast Asia or the Pacific, in sub-Saharan Africa, where that's definitely not the case. And oftentimes there are spaces in Southeast Asia or sub-Saharan Africa where even the notion of indigenous rights isn't really clear. You know, even the definition of who actually is an indigenous person is hotly debated. So you see different ways in which this confluence of legislative, constitutional, even UN-mandated and corporate proclamations and guidelines for taking into consideration indigenous peoples and the environment take shape differently in different places.
All right.
This is Michael Ross. Can I get in on this?
Please.
I think, you know, what Susanna's saying is really, really important and easy to overlook. Many of us who follow these issues are aware of these stories, like in the Congo, like in Ecuador, of these endemic struggles that seem kind of hopeless. But in particularly the last, say, 5 years, there has been a whole movement responding to this. And we see now even governments in places where you wouldn't expect this kind of efforts to improve things really taking this issue seriously. So in places like in Mongolia, Mexico, Guinea, suddenly governments are influenced largely, I think, by NGO movements and by other international organizations working on this, adopting reforms that really could be meaningful, you know, that really, really might make a difference. It's a little bit early to say, but the struggle, which at one time was really all very kind of micro level on the ground around these extraction sites, now is also taking place in the halls of governments in capital cities. And that's actually a pretty interesting and exciting thing.
You've led me right into where I wanted to go, Michael Ross, because you've also explored some of the policy changes that could have an impact. You've talked about, for example, decentralization being one possible way of approaching a future policy. If you were going to lay out what you thought were the most important changes, policy-wise, globally, locally, what would you say?
First of all, I think the first thing that has to be said is that there are no magic solutions. There are no silver bullets here. Everybody in the development world always thinks there's some magic answer, and if we just implemented it, and I just don't think that's the case. I think, as Susanna was implying, you know, that you go from case to case, and in different local conditions, people are struggling to find different kinds of solutions. I think everywhere it's important, though, that there be a lot more transparency. You know, the minerals industry and the oil industry in particular is vast and dominates large parts of the world, and yet it's extraordinarily opaque. I mean, you go down to the gas station on the corner and you have no idea where that stuff comes from. Everywhere else you go to buy something, it has a little country of origin label, but not at the gas station. So bringing transparency, I think, is, if nothing else, the first step in a lot of different situations towards getting policies right, towards fixing some of these problems.
Just a reminder that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. And we're talking about the relationship between the so-called extractive industries, such as mining and drilling, and conflict, poverty, and authoritarianism. Jeff Mantz, you've written a bit about some of the policy changes that have already started. For example, here in the U.S., I think it was Dodd-Frank Act. How do you see this having an impact yet, if it is? And if not, how do you see it having an impact?
There's an interesting sort of difference here in the case of the Congo. You don't have, like, very many indigenous sorts of rights and environmental movements and that sort of formalization kind of thing in the Congo with respect to non-governmental organizations. That has more to do with the fact that until 1996 they were backed by a U.S. finance dictator who was, you know, an enemy of communism and ruled very much with an iron fist. So you didn't have these kinds of alternative forms of civil society kind of emerging. But so it's bit more of a specific case. But in the case of the Congo, you have scores of these organizations that are coming in from elsewhere. It used to be that they were very concerned about sort of the ecological damage in the Congo about 10 years ago. Increasingly, they were concerned about the humanitarian damage, particularly around gang rape by soldiers and these sorts of things. A few of these organizations in particular that were responsible for getting Dodd-Frank, Section 1302 added to the Dodd-Frank Act, the Financial Reform Act. And this basically created a sort of stigma around Congolese coltan as well as cassiterite, it's tin, wolframite, which is tungsten, and gold. And basically requires the SEC to require companies to exercise due diligence in proving that their minerals are not coming from conflict zones. Sounds all great on paper, except there's not really a good way of verifying this. And the problem that I've written about actually is not Congolese coltan. It's all the other coltan that's laundered everywhere else. That's really where the stigma should be. I really don't see anything kind of changing there because of the SEC getting involved in this process. In fact, I see it as potentially officious and just a new form of regulation kind of imposing itself on the Congolese that they'll see as any other kind of colonial, post-colonial sort of apparatus. That where the hope kind of lies, I think, is in some initiatives that we see on the ground where Congolese have decided maybe that if they demonstrate transparency in their own mineral process and use social media to document it, put RFID tags on bags, and start doing this on their own, then they can have a, you know, genuinely Congolese-certified method of demonstrating clean coltan or clean gold or any of these kinds of things. And that, I think, is just good for the Congo in general. I mean, I think the Congo's 500-year history of problems is really related to outsiders meddling in it and things the Congolese are perfectly capable of doing on their own. So that's where the significant transformation needs to be taking place.
Now, the war is officially over there, but I understand it's still pretty heavy in terms of the conflict. And some people argue that the current conflict going on in the Central African Republic has some similar dynamics and, of course, refugee camps being filled since they're right next to each other. Do you have a sense of what's going on now?
They're two different conflicts. They're not completely unrelated, but they relate to different kinds of concerns. They're parallel sorts of concerns. They're parallel sorts of dilemmas and problems. There's leadership issues. There are, you know, conflicts over land scarcity on the ground that translate into ethnic kinds of disagreements. There's political economic dimensions to this involving the trafficking of certain items, most of which goes out through East Africa. There's overlaps with these two situations, both being in the Francophone world, and they neighbor one another, and then there's been conflicts. Kony is the most famous of which is the Lord's Resistance Army is kind of, you know, who wandered into the CAR after being in the Congo for quite some time. So it's a series of problems that you see in as well in South Sudan and Chad and lots of other parts of Africa, but they're not directly related in a real sense.
Michael Ross?
I have to say, I really don't know much about the CAR conflict. There's always some resource dimension to most conflicts, particularly as you get to poorer and poorer countries, and people's living more and more depends on, you know, their interaction with natural resources, then you always see something. But I can't really say that I know anything about what kind of role, if any, it plays in this conflict.
Now, you have done some work around poverty and resources as well, and you just mentioned the issue of poverty. So I'm wondering if you could help us to understand how this is happening, where you have such, like in the case of the Congo, you've got an essentially rich landscape, and yet you've got such poverty going on in the country. What is the relationship there? Maybe it's also tied into the governance question that you also looked at.
Mm-hmm.
Is it tied into governance?
Yes, I very much think so. I think there's a lot of different kinds of economic activity that don't depend that much on what the government does. You know, you can have a pretty corrupt government like you do in, say, China, but you can still have thriving industries and factories and retail businesses. The mineral industry, the extractive industry, is kind of different. The government always plays a central role, partly because in almost all countries of the world, the U.S. being the big exception, whatever that's valuable that's below the ground belongs to the government. And so the interaction between companies and governments is critical. And if the government is corrupt and weak and unaccountable, then you're almost certain to see that the revenues, the money that comes from extracting resources is going to be squandered. You really need an accountable government, a transparent government, a government that's strong enough to stand up to companies and get their fair share, to regulate them properly. You need to have all of the elements of good governance, and they become even more important in countries that are based on extractive industries than they are in just your average country.
May I interject for a second?
Please, Susanna Sawyer.
I just wanted to pick up on what Michael was saying a little bit and bring back his thought about transparency also. I absolutely agree with what Michael's saying. And then there's maybe another dimension that we should think about, and that is at least the role of particular large extractive corporations, their role in sustaining and generating particular corrupt practices within government, so that governance and government accountability and government transparency is so often intertwined in actual corporate activity. And it seems that one of the places to really think about transparency, and this is, you know, more speculative, would be through imagining maybe a multiplicity of different actors involved at a larger, maybe even UN-type level of structure. Because to me, in my research, both in Latin America and then other research in the extractive industries that you had mentioned earlier, it's the relationship often between corporations and governments and the lack of transparency between those two that is critical also to imagining a more just reality for people in countries and across the world. I would just make a plug for, you know, the United Nations has a special representative, John Ruggie, faculty member at Harvard, who has done extensive work on the relationship between business and human rights. And the work that the group of scholars that he's engaged with across the world might be a good platform for building larger and larger networks.
Susanna's points are so salient and so right on. We forget that when it comes to these relationships between governments, particularly in low-income countries, and these companies, the companies are so much vastly larger than the governments. I mean, the entire economy of a country like the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, is only a small fraction of the size of, say, a Shell or an Exxon. These companies have enormous influence in these places. And even though international initiatives have focused up to this point really on bringing transparency to governments, companies, which are so important and so wealthy and so influential, have kind of been flying under the radar. And, you know, a lot of this stuff just doesn't apply to them. So I think the point is very well taken that Susanna made.
Do you think the free trade agreements that have been occurring for the last couple of decades have obfuscated this even more?
This is Jeff Mance. Absolutely. There's a huge literature devoted precisely to that question. I think what's most obscuring about this is the fact that people tend to think of free trade in a very sort of digested sort of way. That means opening up of economies. And actually, what it does, particularly in the case of the WTO, it creates an international administrative legal apparatus that polices different kinds of agreements. And like any kind of set of international, like any kind of legal forum, there are certain people that have resources to pursue certain kinds of claims. There are certain kinds of stakeholders that are better litigators than others. And we have to remember that these free trade agreements are between countries, not between companies.
Thank you so very much for sharing your research and your thoughts with us. Jeff Mance, Michael Ross, Susanna Sawyer, thank you so very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Jeffrey Mance is a professor of anthropology at George Mason University. His publications include Improvisational Economies, Colton Production in the Eastern Congo, and How a Huckster Becomes a Custodian of Moral Markets. Michael Ross is a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, and director of the Center for Southeast Asian Studies. He's the author of The Oil Curse, How Petroleum Shapes the Development of Nations, and Timber Booms and Institutional Breakdown in Southeast Asia. Susanna Sawyer is a professor of anthropology at the University of California, Davis. She is the author of Crude Chronicles, Indigenous Politics, Multinational Oil, and Neoliberalism in Ecuador. She's also co-editor of The Politics of Resource Extraction, Indigenous Peoples, Corporations, and the State. That is it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests. An extra special thanks to Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, and Huatemoc Aileman, who produce this show each week, and to Sud Dongre, our webmaster and web host. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed any part of the show, you can go to scholarcircle.org or armudian.com or kpfk.org. You can also hear us on Stitcher, on iTunes. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at armudian. See you next week.